Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Whenever folks put together a list of up-and-coming Republicans, it'll always include Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, the youngest member of the U.S. Senate, an Army veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I had a chance to sit down with him the other day to talk about climate change, Russia, health care, and his journey from rural Arkansas to the United States Senate. Senator Tom Cotton, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
In reading up on you, one of the things that struck me right away was that politicians like to talk. That came to you late. You wrestled as a kid in Arkansas, in small town Arkansas, with a speech impediment.
I did, yeah. So apparently I didn't speak until I was about 3 years old, which I obviously don't remember, but my sister reminds me of. And I can remember going into elementary school, second or third grade. You know, other kids would go out on the playground and play around in the jungle gym, the monkey bars, and I'd be in class working with a speech therapist from the school, learning how to pronounce words.
Yeah, and was this painful for you, or...?
Not in particular. I remember having it and struggling and sometimes being frustrated, usually my parents who couldn't understand me at the time. But I didn't, you know, get mocked or teased on the playground about it. My mom now likes to joke that, you know, look at, you know, he couldn't talk to you, he was three, and look at him now.
Yeah, no, I think I mentioned to you before that Joe Biden, you know, famously had a very bad stutter, and his mother said to him, Joey, those thoughts are just coming so fast they can't get out. And obviously he overcame that problem.
Yeah, mother's love is a great thing, and I see that with my mom and me, but I see it now with my wife and my kids.
Talk to me about your folks and about your little town in Arkansas.
Yeah, I grew up in a very rural setting in Dardanelle, actually just outside Dardanelle, a small cattle farm. My parents still live in the farm.
So suburban Dardanelle.
Yes, suburban Dardanelle. Yes. Unincorporated. county land. You know, my father's never had a vote for mayor in his life. It was kind of a, you know, very idyllic upbringing.
Family, you know, there for generations.
My father's family had been there.
Where'd they come
from?
Late
19th century. Tennessee, most immediately. Mm-hmm. My mother's family had been in eastern Arkansas in a similar community, and they had met at the University of Arkansas. But, you know, I had a grandmother and a great aunt there. And both of those, my great aunt didn't have any children or grandchildren of her own. So we were kind of like her children and grandchildren, spent summer months with them. You know, you get on your bike in the morning, they could turn you out and be confident you'd make it back safe in the evening. And if you did anything wrong during the day, that your neighbors or friends or church members or what have you would report back to you. You figure that out pretty quickly as well. And, you know, my parents are just, you know, great salt of the earth people. You know, my father's very civic-minded. All Democrats. Yeah. That's pretty much everyone was in those days. And to this day, there's a lot of counties in Arkansas where if you want to vote for your county judge or your sheriff or your JP, you have to vote in the Democratic primary. That's changing to a degree, but it's still the case in many counties. That said, they were all very conservative, too. I didn't grow up in a political family. My father was very civic-minded. He coached Little League. He helped get lights for the field. He's in the Rotary Club. He's been the voice of Dardanelle Sand Lizard football for 30 years now. But not politically active, no bumper stickers, no yard signs, in part because all politics was Democratic Party primary politics, so it's mostly personality-based. So didn't want to offend the other person. So I didn't grow up in a political household, a conservative in the sense of like a William F. Buckley conservative mm-hmm. movement household, but it was a very conservative household in the sense of a traditional household. Like I had to go work on the farm from the time I was five. I had to try to earn my own keep, you know, taught, you know, traditional upbringing about differences between right and wrong and personal responsibility and individual initiative and so forth.
But the big ubiquitous political figure in Arkansas during your youth was Bill Clinton.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I guess I didn't know that there was something other, someone could be governor other than Bill Clinton until he got elected president. But he was elected attorney general a few months before I was born, then governor about a year after I was born. And except for a 2-year period in the early 1980s, he was, you know, either governor or president, you know, for my entire life until I was 24. And again, you know, all those races are primarily about the primary in those days. But, you know, he'd come to our home county, Yell County, a lot. He'd be at the Yell County Fair. There's pictures of me and my Arkansas Razorback shirt when I'm 4 years old with my sister, with Bill Clinton standing behind us. Much younger Bill Clinton.
He was like a preternatural politician, though.
Yeah, he was a really great politician, you know, probably one of the best on the campaign trail. Interestingly, you know, I think another great politician came from Arkansas, Mike Huckabee.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly skilled, gifted campaigner and communicator. They both
also
had,
from Hope, Arkansas,
yeah,
right?
You know, Bill Clinton grew up more in Hot Springs than in Hope. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound as good in the campaign
right,
video.
Exactly.
But after about 6 months of his life, his
I
mom
still
moved
believe
to
in
Hot
a
Springs.
Place called Hot Springs is not as good a speech.
Yeah. But, you know, they both grew up in rural Arkansas around, you know, people who work with their hands and work on their feet. You know, Mike Huckabee had the added, you know, perspective of being a Baptist preacher and having to deal with all the problems that any preacher has to deal with. But I think that gave both of them the kind of common touch and the feel on the campaign trail that made them so successful, that helped make Bill Clinton president and came close to making Mike Huckabee our Republican nominee in 2008.
Did you learn anything as a politician from watching those guys?
You know, I learned a lot of the things at the point that you've made in your book or in your comments that, you know, when you're in campaigns, you have to speak to the common concerns of the voters. And in a place like Arkansas, those concerns are making ends meet, being able to pay the bills at the end of the month and put clothes on your kids' back and food on their table. Oftentimes, especially today, you know, as you know, certain communities in New York and Washington and Silicon Valley get more divorced from that common experience, people forget about that. They forget that, you know, an extra $10 on the gas bill or the electricity bill or, you know, a few extra bucks on taxes makes a big difference. I mean, and you've, you know, written about that, you know, in your campaign.
Or healthcare.
Yeah. With President Obama. Just that it's those common basic concerns of day-to-day life really make a difference to most voters. And if you're blessed to not have those concerns the way a lot of people in Washington are, then you can easily fall out of touch with that. Bill Clinton never did that.
So what made you, you said there was not, yours was not a political household. What made you interested in politics and what made you a conservative and a Republican? I mean, conservative you've spoken to, but when did you have this awakening that led you to be who you are?
So in 1992, I was 15 and I started reading the news. I don't know if that's because I was in history class finally and I was just interested in events or if it's because Bill Clinton was running for office. But, you know, I read the Democrat Gazette front page each day that summer and that fall, not just the sports pages. And I was, you know, I didn't have a partisan background, I didn't have a political view. I was just kind of astonished that my governor was running for president and got elected president and was president.
Big deal in Arkansas.
Very big deal. And then in 1993, as I watched his first year in office, I realized, like, wow, I can't believe my governor is doing these things as president. I must be a Republican.
Meaning?
The two big things I remember were the tax increases, you know, having campaigned on a middle-class tax cut, and especially the Battle of Mogadishu after, you know, the Black Hawk Down scenario and withdrawing from Mogadishu. You know, I was in a junior ROTC program at the time. You know, I'd had, you know, both of the men who ran that program, the Lieutenant Colonel and the E-7, were Vietnam vets, as my dad was. And it was pretty appalling to them and to me, listening to them, that you commit troops to such an occasion with half measures. Either you go all in or do nothing at all.
On the tax increases, it's interesting because you're right that people do lose touch and people in San Francisco or New York may not have the same concerns that people in Arkansas have about making ends meet and so on. That tax increase that Bill Clinton passed was on people who were making over $200,000 a year. He he walled off those people who you're talking about and who you represent. Why was that so offensive to you?
Well, also, I mean, he'd campaigned on a middle-class tax cut and didn't deliver on that. And then there were some other parts of that that didn't become law, you know, the famous BTU tax the House voted on, the Senate never did, that just didn't seem very sensible to me at the time. I was 16 years old, so I didn't have a nuanced and sophisticated economic, examination of them. It just didn't seem like the right course of action at the time. The Battle of Mogadishu stuck out more clearly to me, though. I mean, that was simpler, more elemental. And it's remained so, you know, since I've gotten to know some of the people who served in that battle.
Your father was a veteran, correct?
He was, yeah. So my dad was an infantryman in Vietnam. He got out of college in 1967 when you could roll one deferment into another. He'd always thought, that he wanted to be wanted to coach football. So he became a high school coach and teacher, realized that wasn't his calling after all. He spent a year dealing with high schoolers. And so he decided in the spring of 1968 that he didn't want to stay in a job just because it had a deferment, as so many people did back in those days, and just he would do his duty. So he decided, first he was going to join the Marine Corps. And then my grandfather had been in the Navy in World War II and seen, you know, what Marines faced then, and threatened to disown him if he joined the Marines, which I've never really figured out why that was a effective threat, since he didn't really have any inheritance to disown him from. But he ended up joining the Army instead and did about 2 years. So he did, you know, less than a year training, and then his 1 year in Vietnam as an infantryman, and then came back to the United States.
Was it always in your mind that obviously, you had an interest in all of this. If as a 16-year-old, Mogadishu was something that helped form your political thinking, you went to Harvard and you then went into a law firm and then you enlisted.
Yeah,
was that always in your mind that you wanted to serve?
No, that certainly wasn't part of a plan. I left my law practice and joined the Army. Because of the 9/11 attacks. But when I was in high school, we had a very popular and big junior ROTC program. And the retired Lieutenant Colonel and E7 there were both Vietnam veterans. So I certainly learned a lot from them as well. I think, you know, they were both appalled by what had happened in Mogadishu, that we, you know, committed to half measures, and as opposed to just saying this is not our fight or going all in on it. My father... you know, we talk a lot about Vietnam, especially when we were out on the farm. You know, we grew up on this cattle farm, and from the time I was 5 or 6, you know, I was the farmhand. My mother was able to go home, thankfully for her. So, you know, all the time, you know, he just, you know, would be in the woods, and it might be raining, and, you know, a helicopter would fly over, and he'd talk about reminding him from Vietnam. So I had...
What was the experience for him? Because that, you know, I'm older than you are. And I was not old enough to be in that... generation per se, but I was old enough to know how difficult the experience was, and difficult for veterans when they came back.
Yeah, it was tough fighting. So he was in Vietnam from the summer of 69 to the summer of 70. And, you know, Nixon had campaigned in 1968 in part on bringing the Vietnam War to an end. So I think some people thought the fighting would wind down quickly as opposed to becoming more intense. And he was out in the jungle for, you know, at least half of the time he was in Vietnam. And sometimes he was out walking point for the infantry squad. So it was tough fighting. I mean, it was tougher, I'd say, than what I personally faced in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, most veterans look back on the previous war and think, you know, we've got it bad now, but at least we didn't have it like that, I'm sure. Yeah. Those guys in Vietnam said the same thing about Korea, said the same thing about World War II, but it was tough fighting. He didn't, you know, when I was growing up, he didn't glorify, you know, combat. You know, he didn't spend a lot of time reminiscing about his time in the Army. But when timing was appropriate, he would, you know, bring up lessons or memories from it. Like I said, you know, being in the wood line when it's rainy and you can smell the foliage and helicopters coming over, I'm sure that would bring back a memory of Vietnam. Or, you know, when we're getting ready to go out, you know, to deer camp, you know, you look, go into the living room and everything is laid out on the floor, you know, in a dress right dress fashion. You know, I didn't appreciate it at the time, but that was a skill that he learned in the Army, and he'd point out like how you learn these things in the Army and so forth. Now, he later said when I joined the Army, which he very much opposed, that he felt like God was punishing him for what he had done to his father in 1968.
Why did he oppose it?
just thought, you know, I'd gone to Harvard and Harvard Law School and got this fancy education, you know, what he had wanted me and my sister to always do, not necessarily be a lawyer, but go on, you know, to get a good degree and become, you know, professionals who could work in office and their air conditioning the way so many people don't have the good fortune to do so, especially in rural Arkansas. And then I was going to give all that up to go be an infantryman. And in particular, in 2004, you know, that was a time when
wasn't going well.
The war was spiraling out of control and continued for a couple more years. You know, it was when Pat Tillman was killed, someone else who had left a pretty good job to go fight on the front lines. So in addition to what he thought I was leaving behind in my professional life, he was obviously very concerned, as was my mother, about the safety of their son, as any parent would be.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Senator Tom Cotton. Talk to me about your experience in Iraq and Afghanistan and what you learned from that.
Well, I was very fortunate in the Army that I got to do exactly what I wanted to do. You know, on the morning of September 11th, 2001, I was in law school, and I thought I was going to be a lawyer, and that day pretty changed my plans dramatically, obviously. I completed school and practiced for a couple of years to pay off my loans, but then I joined, and I joined to be an infantry officer and lead platoon in combat, and that's what I got to do within, you know, barely a year and a half of being in the Army. A lot of people join to do those things and they don't have that opportunity. And I did. And it was, you know, hardest job you could have, you know, leading 40 men in combat, you know, when there's bad guys all around you trying to kill you and try to kill your men, but rewarding and inspiring and just, you know, incredibly great privilege to be able to fight for a free country alongside, you know,
citizens. Did all 40 come back?
In my platoon, they did. Not in my company or battalion, unfortunately. In my platoon, though, we came back and didn't have any serious wounds while I was there. You know, by the time I was there in 2006, the enemy had developed tactics and techniques and procedures in fighting to that usually meant you weren't going to have protracted battles. Like, you know, there was, I mean, anytime you're in a firefight, it seems very protracted. But the kind of, you know, hours-long battles that you might have seen, say, at Combat Outpost Keating, that Clint Romichet won the Medal of Honor for, mm-hmm. And that he has a new book about, was pretty rare in Baghdad at the time. The enemy knew that because of our superior firepower and mobility that they couldn't stand and fight us. So the most common kind of enemy technique was roadside bombs, IEDs, or sniper fire. So we certainly got exposed to our share of that. But fortunately, you know, through good training and discipline and good equipment, everybody came home alive.
Let me ask you this: as a student of foreign policy and less than as a someone who participated in the war, the decision to go to Iraq is a highly debated matter. And looking back. And based on what you know now, do you think it was the right thing to do?
I think that's a hard question to ever answer. I mean, looking back on what I know now, I definitely would have sent the Pacific Fleet out of Pearl Harbor on December 6th. I mean, you don't get to live history in reverse. Right. So you've got to take the measure of decisions of statesmen at the time they act and on the information on which they act.
I'm not asking in a condemnatory way, but I'm trying to draw some lessons from.
No, I think there are certainly lessons to be drawn, both from the decision to go to war and especially the way the war was waged. But I think given where we were in late 2002 and early 2003, the attack that we had faced, what not only our intelligence services, but pretty much every Western intelligence service believed, I think George Bush made the responsible decision. Now, one lesson we should draw from that is to be more skeptical and probing about intelligence, especially when you're making a decision to go to war in part on that intelligence. And then certainly there are lessons to be drawn about the way the war is conducted in the first 3 years. But I think looking back on it, given what was known at the time, that George Bush made the responsible decision.
The, you know, one big debate that's, you know, we're still there, obviously, and one of the reasons is that it is very difficult to, in a place that doesn't have democratic institutions, to install them when there are other deeply rooted rivalries, ethnic divisions, religious divisions, and so on. Is that a lesson to be drawn from this, that we should be a little more humble in our aspirations about what we can do if the parties on the ground are not willing to do it?
We should be modest and tempered about our ability to remake the world in all cases. That's certainly something that I learned in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you can look at our own history or Great Britain's history. I mean, to get to where we were today took many centuries of democratic development, and the idea that countries that have been governed by tyranny or have descended into anarchy for decades or centuries are all of a sudden going to have Jeffersonian democracies is something that you should view with an appropriate degree of skepticism. So, that's one reason why, even though I wasn't in public office at the time, I did not support the airstrikes in Libya in 2011, because it was pretty clear to me that there was no planning whatsoever for any kind of follow-on stabilization operation, nor that we were in the kind of dire straits, given the threats that we faced in 2003 from Iraq, as that we were in 2011 in Libya. And that's another place that lives on. You know, there's a long after party going on in Libya right now that the United States, and especially Europe, is still dealing with. And that's just, it's a society that's never had democratic governance. It's never have pluralism. It's still deeply tribal in the way a lot of those countries in that region of the world are.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing to wrestle with, because the choice would have been to allow Gaddafi to march on and probably see a genocide that followed, versus the question that I think is the hardest in foreign policy and national security, which is, okay, if we do this, what next? What happens next? It's, you know, we have the greatest military in the world. We can roll over anyone. And this is part of what we're dealing with in Iraq and Syria now. The question is, then what? What's left behind? Is there governance? Are we mired there, without limit forever?
Mm-hmm. And David Petraeus, when he took over, said that it was going to be a very hard task, but, you know, hard is not impossible. And I agree with that as well. And we made a lot of gains in Iraq in the years after I left, after the surge. I came back to the United States from Iraq just a few weeks before George Bush lost the 2006 elections, and then dumped the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group, which I strongly opposed, but I was also surprised that he would strike out on his own. I think in retrospect, we'll look back and say that was his finest hour. But, you know, we didn't, when President Obama withdrew all troops in 2011, it was not a Jeffersonian democracy. Was it stable? Was it largely representative? Did it largely have a monopoly on force? Yes. But it was not a Jeffersonian democracy the way the United States or Great Britain is. And it's probably going to be a long time before a lot of countries around the world achieve that level of political development. And we have to, have our eyes open about that. One of the main arguments against going on the kind of Wilsonian nation building effort is the very plethora of opportunities you have to do so all around the world.
Right. And because of the difficulties that you mention, you may well be committing the U.S. to a unlimited engagement. And there's a limit. You must hear it from your own constituents. Certainly, President Trump spoke to this during his campaign. There's a limit to people's patience in terms of the loss of, particularly the loss of life, but also the loss of resources.
Yeah. Well, in a democracy,
that these engagements require.
And in a democracy in particular, statesmen have to be attuned to durable political support for any foreign policy. We're living in a time now, and I don't mean 2017, I mean the last 26, 27 years, in which our statesmen have struggled to do something that they've never done before in over 200 years of our history, which is to develop a peacetime strategy for global leadership. You know, we've never had to do that before. In the founding era and in the Monroe system, which really lasted from the Monroe Doctrine up to World War I, we were able to coast in Great Britain's wake. And then we did not have a successful strategy, to say the least, during the interwar period. And then after World War II, we were able to develop a strategy for global leadership, but in a period of very heightened tensions, a Cold War that often turned hot. So since that ended, we've asked our statesmen to do something that I would say they haven't done the best job of achieving through multiple presidencies.
The in that, I want to return to your story because going from the service to serving in Congress is an interesting leap as well, and many are making it now. But I want to ask you about this, since you raised it, this post-war period and the global institutions that arose as a result of it, one of which being NATO. You know that there's this debate going back and forth as to what the role of NATO should be and the U.S.'s support for it. There was some doubt left in the wake of President Trump's visit to Europe about it. What's your sense of the importance of NATO and the U.S.'s responsibility to stand up for it and Article 5 of NATO, which means we defend NATO members against attack?
NATO is a security alliance. It's not a charitable organization. We don't belong to it because of humanitarian impulses. We belong to it because it's in our interest. Part of our interest is to ensure that there's no single power that dominates the European continent and can use that dominance to threaten our position in the world. That's why we founded NATO. That's why Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis recently said if NATO didn't exist, we'd have to create something like it. I disagreed with some of the things that President Trump said in the campaign about NATO. Some of the things, though, are very consistent with what President Obama and President Bush and John McCain and other long-serving statesmen have said about
in terms of encouraging
the need
countries
to contribute to our common defense. You know, in the Cold War, it was 50-50 Europe versus North America. Now it's about 70-30 the other way. So that's over $100 billion a year that's not being invested in our common defense. You know, that's
we should
10
be,
aircraft carriers a year.
We should be clear by contributing, it is a matter of contributing to their own defense investments.
And as Jim Mattis
said, it's not as if everybody's throwing money in the pot.
Contributing,
I think that's misunderstood.
Yeah, contributing to their own defense. You know, it was a political commitment, you know, a little over a decade ago to say we're going to contribute 2% of our annual economic wealth to our common defense. And a lot of those, even though it's investment in your own national systems or soldiers, are specifically designed to be interoperable to face the challenges that we do from Russia or from terrorism or so forth. I mean, we want them to contribute the right way, not the Greece way, by shrinking the denominator so their defense spend gets up to 2%. But it does have real consequences in our ability to project power. I mean, if you look in Libya, I mean, this was something where Europe led on the effort, but the United States had to provide much of the material support. Or France's foray into Mali in 2013, one of their old colonies where they still have deep ties and Islamic terrorism had spread. I think they probably took the right action, but very quickly we had to provide them strategic airlift and refueling capabilities because so many European countries have taken a holiday from history over the last 25 years. So some of the things that the president said in the campaign were very much in keeping with both parties' views of NATO for the last 25 years. Some of the things, like his questioning of Article 5 in the campaign, I disagreed with. At this point, though, I don't think the president and the vice president and his cabinet can do much more to reassure our European allies that we stand by our commitments. At a certain point, our European allies just are going to have to accept that Donald Trump is the president.
Wouldn't it be easy to go and face them as he just did and just assert it in unambiguous terms?
I mean, that's what I heard from his speech last week. I think our European allies are on guard to hear whatever possible slight they can. I mean, because I think a lot of them just don't like Donald Trump. That's understandable. Leaders often don't like each other. I'm sure you could tell us some stories about Barack Obama not getting along well with foreign leaders. George Bush didn't get along well with foreign leaders. Our alliance is not built on national leaders, though. Our alliance is built on our peoples and our strategic situation. And you can work through, you know, George Bush and Jacques Chirac, for instance, famously did not have the best personal relationship.
Yeah.
But they had advisors and ministers who could work together to make sure that whatever personal antipathy they might have, the U.S.-France relationship remained the same. At a certain point, yeah,
it is true that presidents don't get along with leaders. It's not always true that presidents don't get along with whole continents or, you know, this seems a little more pervasive.
But I mean, look at what, you know, Barack Obama, when he traveled to Berlin in the summer of 2008, how many people turned out for him?
I was there. 250,000.
I mean, his manner, his style, his rhetoric, everything about him is more appealing to the European mind than Donald Trump. Almost everything about Donald Trump is just not appealing to the European mind.
Well,
that, I mean, that doesn't mean that we don't have a strong relationship. That doesn't mean that we that our NATO alliance is strained. It does mean that they're going to have to find ways to work with the person the American people elected to be their president.
There's, you know, or work around them.
Well, ultimately, he's the president. He's the one that represents.
But as you know, you saw Chancellor Merkel say, we're going to have to do, we can't rely on.
She should take more responsibility for Germany and their common defense. And she should take more responsibility for some of the problems that Europe has that have been driven in part by German policy over the last 10 or 12
years. Is it in the U.S. interest, though, if other countries say, you know what, we're going to work around the U.S., we'll do it ourselves. Is that good for the United States?
No, and
it seems to me the United States has played a real organizing role since World War II that has been constructive for the world.
That's right. Ultimately, they don't have all that much choice but to work with us because of our economic might and especially our military might. I mean, the next day after Chancellor Merkel said that, she kind of walked it back as well. I mean, maybe she was reminded how many tanks she has versus how many tanks the United States has. You see, over the last 10 years, I think, you know, too little focus on Europe by American presidents. And you see that, you know, Europe has struggled a lot over 10 years, in part because as the United States looked to the Middle East, especially under George Bush, and then looked to East Asia under Barack Obama, there wasn't that strong guiding hand in European politics to address some very real challenges that Europe faces, especially in its multilateral institutions like the European Union and the Euro. So I think it'd be better if we continue to play that organizing role. But some of these European leaders are going to have to get over their personal differences or differences in style and manner with our president.
One of the ways in which the last administration, I think the previous administration probably started, tried to strengthen Europe in the ways you suggest was to negotiate a transatlantic trade agreement. That's an area where it seems to me you and the president haven't always been on the same page. What is the wisdom of a Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement with Europe?
On both of those, but in particular the European one, since most of our country is at, or especially in Western Europe, at similar levels of development, I think the sentiment that the president rightly tapped, that was also tapped in the Brexit campaign last year, was the move away from traditional trade deals, you know, that lowered tariffs and quotas or subsidy systems or so forth, and into what you might call, you know, regulatory harmonization schemes. You know, if you're a voter in Great Britain, it's understandable if you're going to reduce tariffs with countries around the world. What's less understandable is why, you know, unelected bureaucrats in Brussels get to dictate the size of your olive oil decanter on your table, to use one example that was common in the Brexit vote. I think that's the sentiment the president tapped into. It's also part of the sentiment that Hillary Clinton was
responding
to.
You think Britain will gain economically from the Brexit decision?
As Theresa May has said, ultimately it'll be in Britain's long-term interest. It'll make Britain more globally minded and stronger to be able to chart their own course in foreign affairs in the world, as they did for so long.
You mentioned Russia.
And like I said, you know, the EU has serious problems. If you look at the divisions between North and South, by which I mostly mean between Germany and the South, and between East and West. So Great Britain may, in retrospect, be seen to have gotten out while the getting was good.
You mentioned Russia earlier. What is your view of Russia relative to Europe, relative to the United States?
Russia,
how would you characterize Russia?
Russia is an adversary. It always has been. Unfortunately, it's always apt to be.
You're on the Senate Intelligence Committee, so you're privy to
an oxymoron, military intelligence.
Yeah, you know, George Bush had a great joke at the White House Correspondents' Dinner some years ago, where he said, "Look, I know some people don't think I'm that smart. Even my own staff, I suspect that's true of them too, because every day they put this intelligence briefing on my schedule." So, you accept the fact that Russia did interfere in our, or tried to interfere in our election last year.
I have no reason to doubt the conclusions of the intelligence community on that.
And so it's not a hoax.
I have no reason to doubt the conclusion that it was Russian intelligence services or affiliated persons and organizations who hacked into the DNC and John Podesta's emails and released them.
On the actually, as we speak this morning, you know, Putin said, well, maybe it was a patriotic Russian, you know.
Vladimir Putin was a KGB officer, once a KGB officer, always a KGB officer. And remember that Russian intelligence services in particular, more so than even most intelligence services, have longstanding patterns going back to the Soviet Union days and the Tsarist days of disinformation, deception, manipulation.
Also of co-opting people who they think might be helpful to them. Do you think some of that was going on as well?
I've seen no evidence of that. And, you know, obviously the Intelligence Committee has a review underway, and we'll follow the facts wherever they lead us. You know, we've done a lot of work already. We've done a lot of interviews. We have more coming. But Dianne Feinstein was the senior Democrat on the committee until January. She's been the senior Democrat on the Judiciary Committee for the last 5 months, meaning that she oversees the FBI. And she said twice in the last month that she's seen no evidence of collusion or wrongdoing by Donald Trump or his associates.
Do you believe that the Russians were trying, not whether it was to help Trump or hurt Hillary Clinton, that they were taking sides in the election?
Well, so the intelligence community assessment didn't just identify Russian intelligence services or their affiliates as the ones who hacked those emails and released them. They also gave some reasons for it. Those reasons include a general effort to discredit Western democracy and American democracy in particular, an effort to pay back Hillary Clinton for some of the things she had said and done during her tenure as Secretary of State.
Putin felt that Americans had interfered in his election.
And Hillary Clinton in particular. Mm-hmm. And he felt slighted by Bill Clinton in the final months of the Clinton administration as well in 1999 and 2000. A third one was a clear preference for Donald Trump. It's possible. I'm still reviewing the evidence, as is every other member of the intelligence community or intelligence committee as part of our review. And it's hard to disentangle those two motives, you know, helping Donald Trump versus hurting Hillary Clinton. In our election system, when it's a first past the post election, you do one, you necessarily tend to do the other. But I think there's sound reasons to think that someone in the Kremlin wouldn't want to elect Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump in the campaign, after all, was the one who was advocating more defense spending, accelerated nuclear modernization, expanded ballistic missile defense, more oil and gas production. Those are things that objectively are not in Russia's interest. So I want to talk to the analysts in the intelligence community who made those conclusions to see the basis on which they made them, both in the kind of in the raw intelligence that we've already reviewed, but also a lot of the basic correlation of forces between our two countries.
I would be remiss if I didn't note that Donald Trump had some shockingly positive things to say about Vladimir Putin during the campaign, and he didn't say much nice about any other international leaders. So that is one more.
Well, he said things about Vladimir Putin that he ought not to have said, and with which I don't agree. But Vladimir Putin, as an old KGB officer, knows to look beyond just what people say and to look what they do. And I'd say if you look at the first 4 months of the Trump administration, it's hard to say that Russia policy has done anything but gotten tougher. I mean, look at the airstrikes into Syria or what we're doing against Iran, one of Russia's main allies in the Middle East. Sanctions have not been lifted. Rex Tillerson and Jim Mattis and Nikki Haley have all said that we're going to stand with Ukraine until not just the Donbass is returned to Ukraine, but until Crimea is returned to them, which puts them, you know, on a more hawkish ground than does most. Well, I mean, he hasn't said that specifically, but he hasn't said the opposite either. But a lot of European leaders, if you talk to them, have basically given up on Crimea ever going back to Ukraine. They think that's a special and different case from the Donbass. Mm-hmm. So I would say that it's hard to say that in the first 4 months of Donald Trump's administration, Russia policy has done anything than gotten tougher.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Senator Tom Cotton. When you heard that Jared Kushner had met with Ambassador Kislyak, who is identified as a kind of key Russian spy master here in the U.S., and then with a Russian banker whose bank was sanctioned by the U.S. government because of the invasion of Crimea, a banker who has close ties to Vladimir Putin. And this all happened in the transition. And reportedly, Jared Kushner asked for a a back channel that would be managed by the Russians, not by that would be out of the reach of American intelligence and so on. What did that say to you?
Well, let me say first, as a general matter, there's nothing inappropriate about members of a transition meeting with representatives of a foreign government. I'm sure that you saw that happening in the transition in 2008 and 2009. Every ambassador and foreign minister probably wanted to make a trip to Chicago and come meet with Barack Obama or with Hillary Clinton or
with the National Security Advisor
or with you or anyone else. I mean, have to remember.
But I doubt that I can't think of another example where a designee of a incoming president met with the leaders of sanctioned institutions and asked for a back channel for communication.
Didn't President Obama send Bill Miller to meet with Iranian leaders in 2008?
Not in a surreptitious way.
Well, the point being that it's completely normal for foreign leaders to be communicating, not just with president-elects and their teams, but with nominees. You probably saw this in 2008 in the middle of the campaign. There's a reason why all those ambassadors go to the RNC and the DNC. And it's not to hear the great rhetoric. It's to build relationships with one of the two sets of people who are going to be leading our government. And
yeah,
I'm not talking
about the ambassador so much as do you consider it customary for representatives to meet with someone like Mr. Gorkov from Venice Economy?
So it's not unusual, and especially in countries where personal relationships matter a lot, for them to send those kind of personal emissaries. I've had some of those people who are, you know, they're not the foreign minister, they're not ambassador, come to meet me shortly after the election, usually from allied countries, because they're looking for contacts inside Donald Trump's world, because they didn't think he was going to win, they didn't develop those contacts. So that's not uncommon, because, again, you have to remember something that it's easy for Americans to forget, even for Americans in Washington, in government to forget. We are the most important country in the world to every country in the world. Like, the diplomat that represents every country in the world that serves in Washington is the most skilled, experienced, important diplomat they have. Our ambassador in their capital is the most important ambassador in their capital. And for many of these countries, their existence depends on their relationship with the United States, which is to say, in no small part, their relationship with the incoming president and his administration. So the meetings that Jared Kushner or Mike Flynn or any other member of the administration had are not out of the ordinary. Now, I can't say what happened in those meetings. And
some of it hasn't been denied.
Jared Kushner has said that he wants to cooperate with the Senate Intelligence Committee and he's willing to turn over documents and interview. And I think we should do that and he should tell his side of the story. I can't evaluate what was said in conversations in private meetings or on phone calls or what have you. But I can say that there's nothing out of the ordinary for foreign leaders to want to meet with an incoming administration.
And you consider Mr. Gorkov from Venetia Conabank a foreign leader?
I don't know all the details about him. I do know, I mean, that's kind of like the export-import bank in the United States. But he also has the way most people who are in positions of influence do, has a personal relationship with Vladimir Putin. So it's not surprising that heads of state send people with personal relationships to meet with the incoming advisors to the president. I mean, I'm sure you saw that some as well.
He said that he was there to talk about business, and he was talking to Kushner in his role as a leader of the Kushner organization, which he was.
I'm not sure I'd credit everything that Mr. Gorkov says. Not saying I discredit it, just saying that I recognize that as someone who's close to Vladimir Putin and who himself went through the Russian Security Service training, I wouldn't credit everything he says in the news.
How do you think that this has been handled by the administration and the president, who is a frequent tweeter on this subject?
Yeah.
Doesn't agree with your analysis.
I think the president
of what happened last year.
I think the president could be more focused and disciplined about staying on his agenda. And I've communicated that publicly as well as privately to him. He won in the campaign because of his agenda, and he's going to succeed in office because of his agenda. I mean, it reminds me of what you said about the kickoff for Barack Obama's reelection campaign in your book. You know, there's some meeting, he comes in with this yellow legal pad.
Yes.
And he's got a long list of issues like climate change and gay rights and immigration that he wants to address. And you had to tell them, like, Mr. President, I'm sure we all agree around this table, but we're still at 8% unemployment and, you know, down so many million jobs. You got elected to deliver on the economy and kitchen table issues. You're probably going to get reelected by focusing on those as well. And as you said, he had gotten somewhat rusty and he'd gotten off focus on those. He got back on focus, and that's one main reason he won reelection. Donald Trump is going to do well if he's focused on things like jobs, wages, and security. To the extent that he's focused on all of the, you know, hair on fire, wild-eyed allegations and drama around these inquiries, he's going to do less well.
Can he? I mean, in your view?
He showed in the campaign that he can be disciplined and focused, absolutely.
In spurts.
Well, enough spurts to win. And again, if he's disciplined and focused like he was on his overseas trips, especially in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia and Israel, he's going to do well. That's not something specific to Donald Trump. That's kind of a lesson of life, a lesson of the military, a lesson of politics. I mean, being disciplined is a pretty important skill to have.
There were 20 senators who sent a letter to the president recommending that he withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. You weren't one of those 20. I presume you were solicited for your signature. Why didn't you put your name on that letter?
The a lot of cross-cutting issues that the president and his team needed to address beyond just the terms of the climate agreement, and I wanted to give the president and his team the space to address those. I think ultimately he probably made the right decision. You know, the left's complaints in the last couple of days can't be reconciled. On the one hand, it can't be a voluntary, non-binding commitment. On the other hand, the last chance for salvation on Earth. It's clear that the Democratic Party and the left wanted it to become essentially binding through moral and political pressure each year, as we weren't able to hit the targets that President Obama had laid out that were much tougher than any other country's targets, and potentially legally binding through lawsuits under the Clean Air Act. And I think for those reasons, he made the right decision. He also stressed that we're going to continue to lead the world in environmental protection. But because of the cross-cutting issues that were outside the climate space as well, I wanted to give the president and his team the space they needed to make
that
decision.
But it's just the left that's been unhappy about that decision, critical of that decision. It's most of the world's leaders. Many business leaders here in the U.S. who feel that it will have deleterious effects and not positive effects on the economy.
I'm skeptical of that. I mean, I heard these complaints after we withdrew about how we're going to no longer become the world leader in solar power. I mean, that's the Paris Accord simply didn't address that. I mean, if we're going to be the world leader in solar power, which I suspect we probably will, it's because we make a better product at a more affordable price. You know, it doesn't, you know, if you're making solar panels yesterday for your job, you're still making them today, and your job is still going to rise or fall based on your company's ability to make a better solar panel and sell it, not whether or not the United States is in a non-binding voluntary agreement.
You're on the panel that Mitch McConnell assembled on healthcare to try and come up with a repeal and replace bill that can pass the Congress. How are you doing? How's that coming along?
It's deliberative. So it's a movable feast, you might say. You know, there's lots of people.
It looks like a movable famine. I don't know.
Well, lots of people coming in and out. I mean, we've probably had half of the Senate Republican caucus now in and out of the meeting. Some senators care more about certain issues on health care, so they're more apt to be there when the conversation turns to Medicaid or the insurance regulations and so forth. Look, Mitch McConnell has said it's going to be a tricky proposition. We've only got,
I mean, he actually cast doubt on whether you can get to the,
yeah, he said that he didn't have the votes now, and he doesn't know how we're going to get to the votes. Now, that's usually the case in a legislature. I'm very much focused on doing so. I thought the House had a false start that set them back a few yards and delayed the effort.
You said an interesting thing. You recommended to House members that they not vote for the bill because you said they'd be walking the plank, and in legislative parlance, that means they'd be voting for a bill that's never going to become law. Did they make a mistake?
No, because they ultimately did what I had counseled them to do from the outset. You know, the House leadership introduced a bill on Monday night, and they were going to start voting on it on Wednesday. And I said they really need to hit pause, take the time to assess all of its implications, because healthcare is a very complicated area of law, and not rush through a product that was half-baked. Now, there was a lot of drama for 2 or 3 weeks there. They ultimately had to pull that bill off of the floor. Congress went into recess. Deliberations continued. In the end, they spent about 8 or 9 weeks on it. And that, in my opinion, what they should have done from the very beginning. The House bill is a start. The Senate will write our own bill. We'll see if we can get 50 votes to pass it. I hope we can, and I hope it improves our health care system.
You, Arkansas has been a big beneficiary of the Affordable Care Act. Your uninsured rate has gone from 21% down, I think, to 8 or 9%, second best performance of any of the states. I think Kentucky is the only one that did better. Do you have concerns about going backward in terms of insurance in your state?
Well, I want everyone in Arkansas, like every American, to have the chance to get affordable and quality insurance. We know that some people are not. If we do something like repeal the individual mandate, that doesn't mean they quote-unquote lose their insurance so much as some of them will choose not to buy their insurance. But if you want insurance and you want to buy it, I want it to be affordable and I want it to fit the needs of that person. One way that we can do that, and our governor in Arkansas stresses this, is by giving states a lot more flexibility and authority over their own Medicaid systems and then holding them to account as well, not letting them spend excessively the way some states have done. That doesn't mean that everybody who's on Medicaid today will stay on Medicaid in the long run. I think it's better that we move people off of Medicaid and into market-based insurance, whether that's the individual market.
That's what you got. In Arkansas, they got a waiver from the Obama administration to use the Medicaid money to buy into the health care.
So essentially, we still have the traditional Medicaid program, which supports the traditional Medicaid populations, which no one disputes need that kind of support. The indigent elderly, the disabled, the blind, and so forth. Very important programs to help people have, say, developmental disabilities who are living in open homes. The expansion population, which oftentimes are able-bodied adults, they are not in that traditional Medicaid fee-for-service program. So the waiver that Arkansas got was to use that pot of money for the expansion population to put that group of people on the insurance market itself. Now, we just modified it to some degree. I say we, the governor and the legislature, the state of Arkansas. And that moved about 70,000 people off of Medicaid and into market insurance. Well, they'll have different options, and they'll have a copay and so forth. That's the kind of flexibility that we should give to my governor and to every other state as well.
Some of these plans of the president's budget, for example, foresees a cut in Medicaid. It's over $800 billion. Isn't a state like Arkansas going to suffer from?
I'd say that's a Washington cut. Medicaid spending still goes up every year. And there's real evidence that Medicaid spending.
So does the cost of health care.
Well, but Medicaid spending on a per beneficiary basis has been not just below the rate of medical inflation, it's been below the rate of core inflation for many years. We think that if we give governors and legislatures more flexibility, so they'll have more tools than just cutting payments to doctors, that we can even see higher quality care delivered at a better price for Medicaid beneficiaries. I mean, that's one of the core goals that we have of healthcare reform, is to give governors more flexibility on Medicaid, give them more tools like managed care, for instance, that is very common in the private insurance market, to restrain the rate of growth in Medicaid, but also continue to deliver affordable care.
I don't ask this to be provocative, but I'm really curious about it. It's an interesting point you raise that Medicaid has been below the rate of medical inflation. And I mean, it's a government-run program. Why is that?
I think the main reason is that it's such a huge part of most state government's budget, along with K-12, higher education, and prisons.
But you're suggesting it's managed better.
No, so the common complaint you'll hear from Medicaid about people who are both on Medicaid and from doctors is that it's insurance that doesn't necessarily equal care. A lot of doctors across Arkansas will not take a new Medicaid patient, or they'll take one new Medicaid patient a month. And that's in part because one of the few tools that governors have is to reduce rates of reimbursement for doctors. And it gets to a point where it's simply not economically feasible for a doctor or other healthcare provider to continue seeing an open-ended number of Medicaid enrollees. I think there's better ways to try to restrain the rate of growth of Medicaid without getting people into the situation where they have insurance but they don't have care. Giving the governors flexibility to have a small copay, for instance, or a small deductible, giving them the flexibility to have managed care, giving them the flexibility to use telemedicine. Those are all things that governors don't currently do that are being done in the private insurance markets, and I think we should let them do that. We should see what works.
Lastly, your own future. First of all, I assume you see Donald Trump being the candidate for president in 2020.
Most people, once they get elected to president, like during the job. So I expect Donald Trump will be
not clear that he does. That's why I ask you. But if he were not, is that something that you see in your future?
I'm preparing to run for re-election in 2020, and I suspect that Donald Trump will be our party's nominee in 2020 as well.
I knew you were too cagey to let me inveigle you into some other answer, but I thought I'd give it a try. Senator Tom Cotton, thank you so much for being here, and look forward to future conversations.
Thank you, David. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.